This encore segment of the Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Zombie Economics, a guide to personal finance, a stripped-down, real-world technique for achieving financial stability. Find out more at zombieeconomics.com.
The following is a production of the Emerson News Network.
Hey, it's me. Knock, knock. So, you got my money?
Huh? Oh, yeah, I'll pay you soon.
Yeah, well, here's a suggestion. Have the money by tomorrow and there won't be any problems.
Huh?
Yeah, 24 hours.
Why? What happens in 24 hours?
I don't know. Not psychic, man. I'm just saying it would probably be better for everybody if you had the money tomorrow.
Yeah, all right, I'll see what I can do.
Sweet, sweet, great. How's everything else going?
Good.
All right. See you later. Don't forget. Nah, you're not going to forget.
Stewie. Hey.
Hey there. So, it's been 24 hours. Got my money?
You know what? Just give me till next Friday. I'll have it for you.
Oh, that's funny. I could have sworn I said have it today.
Yeah, I don't have it. Sorry.
Oh, well, all right then. That's good, OJ.
Ah!
Yeah, that hurt?
Ah!
That hurt?
What the hell?
Yeah, it feels so good, does it?
Ah!
No, Yeah, that's what happens, man.
Oh, my God!
Yeah, that's what happens. Where's my money? You gonna give me my money? Where's my money, man? Where's the money? Yeah, you like that? That feel good? That feel good? Where's the money, man? Where's my money? You got till 5 o'clock. You hear me? You got till 5 o'clock.
You freaking psychopath!
Clean yourself up. Good day to you, sir.
After the hour of one, and this is the month of Rocktober, the year of our Lord 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a fun of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, looming high over the milk packing district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. Warning: Dawn Taylor says today's program may make her sound like a racist. So just FYI, if that's a thing you'd rather either A, avoid, or B, gather everyone around the speakers for. So that'll be happening here in just a moment. So I'm told. Let's see. Hold on, let me refer to the fabled pile to my right here. We've got the show matrix containing the following items. Today we're going to be favored with a Nazi watch, cannibal watch. By the way, the Nazi watch, apparently not the thing that's going to make you sound racist.
No.
Is it your racism that's going to do that?
Maybe. Okay. I'll have to leave that to others to decide.
That's my guess, but I could be wrong. Let's see. Nazi Watch, Cannibal Watch, Monkey Watch coming up today. Also, Mr. Justin Stanley from the Uprise Books Project. He'll be here in the studio with us about an hour from now. That's like 2:30 if you're listening live. If not, space and time cease to exist for you anyway, so it doesn't really matter. Let's see. What else we got coming up today? Well, I think that's kind of it. Nazi Watch, Cannibal Watch, Monkey Watch, Justin Stanley. We won't be talking about Sons of Anarchy. Well, we could. You could. I can't.
Could.
I failed to watch it altogether. It's not even, and it wasn't like a Boardwalk Empire thing where, like, I saw it sitting there and I went, oh, yeah, I got to watch that thing. I just completely forgot about it. Here's what I'm going to have to do.
You must have had something really incredibly interesting going on last night, then, if you forgot Sons of Anarchy.
Don't mock me. Don't.
Something hugely important and special and magical.
I'm not here for you to make fun of. I'm not here to be made sport of by you.
Really?
I really am. I really am, actually. Yeah. I wasn't doing it. You know what I was doing last night? I was consolidating a couple of different bags of tortilla chip pieces into one big bag, and then I was tipping it up and I was pouring it into my mouth. because my wife is in Baltimore. That's it.
And that was so entrancing. That was so mesmerizing that you just completely forgot Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, and I found some cream cheese in my glove box, and so I was eating that. So, but it had chives in it, so I think that preserved it. I think that kept it from going bad. Anyway, so that was the extent of my evening. Amazingly, then, the rest of my evening not spent vomiting.
Do you often keep cream cheese in your glove compartment?
Well, I mean, otherwise people will find it.
I mean trunk pizza, cream cheese in the glove compartment. Is there just food randomly stashed throughout your car?
You don't want gypsies to take it. Sandwiches
under the seat?
A little bit.
Oh, wait, that's me.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, not all the time, but I'm just saying it's, it really, when you say it out loud like that, when I say that I had a tub of cream cheese in my glove box, it really does start to sound like sort of insane hoarding-like behavior. But I don't know.
You go looking for a tire iron, it's like, oh, cookies, I forgot I had these.
Well, that does happen every now and again, actually. Also, what I will sometimes find is boxes of Crunch and Munch that I've hidden around the house. But that's because, and it's not even like Laura
would... Are you a squirrel, Rick Emerson? Is that it? Are you just a giant squirrel?
Kind of. But my cheeks aren't really large enough to be holding the requisite amount of nuts for the winter, and so I have to then hide them in my, like in the sock drawer with the paper towels or something. I don't really know why. There was some reason the cream cheese was in my glove box. I don't really remember. I think I may have intended to bring it here, or I may have had it here and was intending to take it home, but just forgot that it was in the glove box. And then,
why was it in the glove box in the first place?
That's a good question, and I don't really have an answer to that. I don't have access to that information at this time. That is a... mistakes were made. I don't... Anyway, let's talk less about the fact that I keep dairy products in my glove box, and more about the fact that I was... anyway, but I was so distracted by all the various, goings-on with the cream cheese and everything. Ooh, and also... I found, way in the back of the refrigerator, I don't know what kind of bread this is, but it's a roundish loaf of bread that has, the crust is sort of salted. I mean, I know they probably do it with more than one kind of bread, but you know what I'm talking about? It has like a sort of, almost like a rock salt.
Yeah, okay.
Kind of,
yeah.
Anyway, they have it at the Little Tea American Bakery, and Lara occasionally picks some up, and I think she got this when she was having she was going over to a friend's house, they're having some sort of like work thing, and she brought some of it home but neglected or just chose not to tell me about it, and so I discovered it in the back of the fridge, and it was on the verge of becoming too stale, even for me.
Well, you're not supposed to put bread in the refrigerator for exactly that reason.
Is that true?
Yes, it will increase, it will make it stale a lot quicker.
Stalification?
In the refrigerator.
Alright. Where are you supposed to keep it? In a bread box?
You're supposed to keep it wrapped in something that can breathe a bit, and then, yes, at room temperature.
Okay, well, I do that. Well, this is... Anyway, so this was... The point is, I'm not to blame here in any way.
No, you just happened across some bread.
No, I was... So there's this half loaf of salted bread in the back, and it was... But it was just... It was on the verge of... And I don't mind my things a bit stale, but it was on the verge of becoming too stale even for me. And so it's like, I had to eat it right then.
Of course.
Like, if I'd waited even an hour, it would have passed the event horizon of unacceptable crispness. And so I had to just, Zoidberg-like, just sort of, the entire... So that's what I... While you were watching Sons of Anarchy, I was eating tortilla chips and cream cheese from my car, and I was gobbling a half loaf of bread from the back of my fridge covered in salt because it was about to be stale.
I was also doing something that I haven't done in a long time. Patrick and I decided to actually play a game that did not involve looking at a computer screen. We actually broke out our box of Settlers of Catan and played Settlers of Catan, on the table.
With the actual, with the dice and the everything?
Yeah.
All right, then. Lara's got she's got the board game, and then she's got like a two-person card game. Well, you have to have three people for that, don't you?
But I went online and I found a guy who had some rules to help speed.
Did you?
Well, yeah, because just about any game now, you can go online and say,
modification.
Does anyone have modification for two-player game? And it was like, well, yes, and then get resources, roll two pairs of dice and get resources for two things, and then go up to 12 cards instead of 10 cards, that
all
kind
right.
of thing.
So she'll be happy to know that.
So, yeah.
Okay.
And it was fun. Yes, because now you can play with her.
Yes, yes. Yeah, well, just for that reason, she has the two-person variation on Catan, which is just the card game. which I think is a thing so you can just like take it with you and like you can just, you know, like you and one other nerd can be playing it. So that's the thing that, so whenever she ropes me into some, because I am not like much of a game guy. I just don't, board games and I, board games to me are like crossword puzzles or trivia that I don't care, but then I become very unlikable when I play them if I get forced into them. So she doesn't do it very often, but every now and again she'll rope me into some Settlers of Catan game and then I just get all like hateful for the
It can, that's a game that can just fill you with rage. Actually playing that game helped me to learn to take competition less seriously.
Because he would just become really aggro about it really quickly.
I used to have a real problem with a lot of games because I would, if people got really aggressive with me in a game, I would take it personally.
Yeah, no.
And I really, when I would go out and play games, when I got together with Patrick, and he had many friends and they played games and we would get together and play like Settlers of Catan and stuff like that, I had to learn really, really quickly to like adapt and to not take being attacked in a game as a personal attack.
Just kick over the board and take him down to the floor.
I would be hurt. Yeah. I would be emotionally hurt. Like, why would you do that to me?
Yeah.
And I would feel sad.
Yeah.
And it was just like, and I knew it was unrealistic at the time, but it was like with my first husband, he tried to teach me to play Risk.
Oh no!
And I would he'd invade my country, and I would take it personally.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but why would you do that? And he's like, because that's the point of the game.
It's world domination. It's the game of global conquest, not global cooperation.
Just leave me alone. Yeah. I'm just trying to build up my country here.
It used to just be Monopoly and Risk, but now every game is designed to do that. Every game is designed to fracture relationships and shatter alliances between friends. So. Which, you know, I guess is that's an upside. But
we always played very very genial Settlers of Catan with my friends. It was actually all very nice. It was like, would you like to trade some resources? Well, yes, I would. Here you go. And it was really only be when we get down to the end when it'd be like, I want to trade with you. It's like, well, no.
No, you can starve this winter.
You're within 1 point. I'm not going to trade with you now.
Yeah.
But up until then, it would be like, well, certainly I will trade with. Well, don't you want to put your road there instead of? Well, I would build here, but it would make you unhappy. So instead, I'll do that. I always found that a lot more more pleasant.
You in this story, you've just become Tosh and Mac, the Gophers. Anyway, because somebody asked me if we were going to be talking about Sons of Anarchy. So we're not. I mean, Dawn could. I probably will not. Or we could wait and do it tomorrow because...
We'll do it tomorrow.
Yeah, I didn't watch it last night. And again, it's not like Boardwalk Empire where I had Boardwalk Empire and I thought to myself, I don't really want to watch this show. There's nothing about it that strikes me as entertaining. I realize now, though, that I really... Because we were talking yesterday about how I moved from the paper planner to my new electronic planner on my iPhone. I am going to have to do that thing that I was only joking about a couple days ago. It will now become a horrible reality. I'm going to have to set reminders for myself in my electronic planner to remind me to watch television shows. Because otherwise I'm just going to... Because I don't do anything live anymore. The whole thing we've all talked about with the DVR and the downloading and the torrenting and the way... You just don't watch anything when it's on. And so if it's not... And because I have such a tiny, tiny fly speck of a brain, if it's not right in front of me, like, I just forget all about it. And so I'm going to have to set, like, weekly reminders to watch various television programs. So we'll talk about that... We'll talk about that tomorrow. You watched Sons of Anarchy, but you also watched... How much of Dexter did you say you watched?
Probably about 10 minutes. I could not get through the entire background thing. The whole thing started with him doing a voiceover, as he does, and it was really sort of... It was in lieu of a previously on, it was him saying, life is funny. Sometimes you got to do this, and sometimes life is like this. And meanwhile, there's like they're flashing scenes from things that happened, and you're going, oh yeah, I remember that. Oh, I remember when he killed that guy. Oh, I remember John Lithgow. And then it got into the whole thing with...
I don't remember anything about the fourth season is my deal. I remember nothing about last year.
I didn't watch last year, but he was like in a relationship with... Kirsten Dunst or somebody like that?
No, it's not Kirsten Dunst. It's Juliana Stiles. Julia Stiles. Who's the House of Glass chick?
Yeah. I always get her and Kirsten Dunst mixed up.
Yeah, that was terrible.
And I guess she was like his.
She was his Padawan.
Yeah,
protege.
And I saw them laying around in bed together and just talking about something else, and something else was happening, and I just went, I don't care.
Yeah.
I realize at this point, I don't care. It started really strong. It started with him, like, killing a couple of guys. And it was really interesting because they were ambulance drivers. And apparently they've been, like, picking and choosing patients in their ambulance to kill and then stealing and selling their organs. And so he like pulled them aside, and so he killed both of them like in the ambulance. So that's kind of cool.
But how would he know that? I mean, that's my other thing. Is like, how is it that Dexter Morgan just discovers?
I don't know.
I'm trying to impose logic on that show, but I.
So I was like, well, okay, I want to hear about that. But then it was like, let me tell you a little bit about my life. And it just kept going on and on and on. And all it did was really remind me of how much I've ceased to care about him and his show. And so I just went, no, I'm not interested. And I turned it off and I went and did something else.
And the ambulance guys, they were just the overture, right? Like they had nothing to do with this overarching story.
No, it was just their opening gambit where you see him and he's like standing there. He's standing in the middle of the road and he's like bleeding or something.
Right.
And you see him on the phone. He's going, I've been stabbed. And then, woo, here comes the ambulance. And there's Dexter lying in the road stabbed. You're thinking, why has Dexter been stabbed? And the ambulance guys get out and then he double-handedly goes, flap with hypodermic needles into their necks, both of them, as they're coming over to check on him. And then you see him, he's got them in the back of the ambulance, and he gives them the thing of, I know you did this thing, I am going to now do exposition on you. And then he pulled out the heart attack paddles and electrocuted them.
Of course.
And then I was kind of like, okay, sure. And now what? And then they went into the whole flashback sequence, and I just went, I realized I just didn't care.
Why would he use heart attack paddles? That's not his methodology at all.
No, it's not. No.
All right.
That's part of why I kind of stopped caring.
I guess that I remember now that he had the... Because I guess the last season I watched was the most recent season. It was season 4. Where Julia Stiles was... I don't know. She'd like been kidnapped and like assaulted by some group of dudes. And I think over the course... And then I think Dexter somehow... He stumbled upon her as she was preparing to like take revenge on them, and he was, you know, you're doing it all wrong. And then it became like a whole master and apprentice thing, or he was like training her in the ways of. But then I forget what happened at the end. I honestly don't remember if she's dead, if she moved away, if she's on a farm somewhere.
Just looking at the flashback thing, there's this thing where she's looking all sad, and he says, I will take the darkness for you, or something. And she's...
See?
So, yeah.
You know what you're doing? You're inoculating me against the desire to ever watch that show again. Not that I needed it.
And I think that was when I actually turned it off, was when he said that.
Yeah.
I think that was the point when I just went, oh, no. I have so many other things I could be... I could be diving into season 5 of The Wire now instead of doing that.
Now, see, but... And it's the thing of, like... And you've almost got the worst of all worlds here, because it's got the... You've got the 1-2 punch of The Wire and Breaking Bad ruining everything else on television for you.
Yeah.
I mean, even with a little misstep like that whole business of Gus Fring's spidey sense telling him about the bomb in the car, even if you grant that and whatever other implausibilities may happen in those shows, they're still just like not even in the same galaxy as a show like Dexter. And so you go and you try to watch, and the first time you watch Dexter, and he uses some computer system that magically grants him access to a fingerprint database in 12 seconds, and you know, and pairs like whatever something he's pulled off a lampshade at the bottom of the ocean, and it tells him exact and shows like a full color picture and like a GPS of where that fingerprint owner is right now. You kind of go, no, I'm done with this. Mm-hmm. Or when he starts, you know, with the my whole thing is I got so tired of his opening and closing narration. Where they kept trying to, like, maintain the tone of the show as this creepy, dark thing, like, long after it had ceased being that, because he himself had ceased, and I think has ceased being a sociopath. I mean, as soon as he, like, legitimately, like, fell in love with Rita, what's-her-name, and was all happy-go-lucky suburban dad guy, and then was all in love with what's-her-name, Julia Stiles last season, it's like, at that point, he... Like, by definition, literally the premise of the show is gone.
Yeah.
Because it was that he was a sociopath pretending to be normal, which was kind of interesting. So that's gone, hence the interest in the show dissipated. All right.
Well, I done. Agree.
All right. Let's see. So what headlines are we following today on this one?
Well, two people are in the hospital after a Edinburgh hottest chili contest. City of Cullman, Alabama will finally serve beer at their Oktoberfest. And because I didn't read it last time and I really like the story, a bear breaks into a house and eats a birthday cake.
Oh, yeah, we just had that last hour.
Yeah.
And we did not.
Somehow failed on that one.
Somebody asked, do you guys think less of people who any time in the last 3 years still say Dexter is one of their favorite shows? I do. Yes. Yes, I do, sir. Not a lot, but a little.
I try really, really hard not to think poorly of people whose tastes are different than mine in entertainment.
I don't think poorly of them, but I do, I think less of their taste in television.
Well, I guess.
I mean, not...
I mean, I have a...
I don't linger on it.
One of my closest friends, like, loves Dexter. And, you know, it's starting to show excited. And all last season, she she was really into it, and she'd mention it in email, and I'd just be kind of like,
I just feel sad for people like that, I guess. I think that's my, and I don't mean to sound, I know it sounds snarky, I mean, but I watched the first 4 years of Dexter. I liked years one and three. The Lithgow season was actually legitimately pretty great television in its way.
Also, I can't really throw stones because there is stuff that I watch that I know is just unrepentant crap.
Yeah, but you don't labor under the illusion that it's good. I think that's the distinction I make. Maybe that's the distinction. If somebody says Dexter's one of their favorite shows, that in and of itself, that doesn't bother me. And in any event, it's not like any of this keeps me up that late at night.
If they said it's one of the best shows on television,
that's it.
Then you'd go, are you retarded?
That's it. That is the distinction.
One of my favorite shows that I have stuck with ever since the very beginning, I will admit, is Gossip Girl.
Yes.
I watch Gossip Girl. I was excited that Gossip Girl was back on. But I would never, ever say that it's one of the best shows on television.
Yeah. No, that is the thing. And you know, it's, people who like Dexter don't like it the way that, let's say, Sarah likes True Blood. That is, I think, the distinction for me. I know a lot of people who will say, well, it's sort of, you know, this big wedge of pulpy entertainment. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like, or popcorn films or Big Ten films. Those are worthwhile pursuits, and they're important. It's important that we have them. But it is when people say that it's one of the best shows on television, as though it's a masterwork. That's the thing that I just can't. And that has nothing to do with me. That is not a reflection on me or my intelligence or even on their intelligence. It's like, that just does such a disservice to so much. That, you know what it is? That makes me angry on behalf of television. That is doing such a disservice
on behalf of people who are actually providing, you know, producing good television.
And also, it just drags. I mean, television, which is your sister, mother, secret lover. All of those. It just drags the whole medium down. The glorious golden teat of the television should not be sullied by using Dexter as the pinnacle example of all that the medium can provide. That's just wrong. You just shouldn't do that. So, anyway, it's like using the Michael Reagan program to explain radio to people. You know, it's not the or like your local morning zookeeper. You don't want to do that. Hey, by the way, not that anybody cares about this, but I will say that I don't know how your morning started, but when I didn't get a chance, I didn't even call you to say that I was going to be running a little bit late today. And in fact, I wasn't as late as I thought I was going to be. But I got in this morning. I'm like, I'll have your news cuts in here in just a second. I'll get your audio or whatever. Because I did that thing of waking up this morning and doing a little work around that, puttering around the house, as they say. Although I made the mistake of waking up early this morning, getting a few things done, and then thinking, I can squeeze in a little tiny nap before which is always a mistake, and I should know better than to do it, because the deal is if I wake up early at like 7:30, as I did today, and then I just stay up, I'll be a little tired, but it's like I'll be more on top of my game than if I go back to bed. And I went back to bed for like 90 minutes, and that was a real mistake, because then I woke up and I was like in a fog, and it just took forever just to burn through this mental haze. And so then I leave the house at like 11:45, I get in the car, I'm driving down the road, and it's that thing where instinctively you know something is wrong. And then you hear the thump, 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 and it's like, and I pull over into this parking lot, and one of my goddamn tires is flat, which is just the worst. Having a flat tire is one of the worst things on earth, not in terms of its actual impact. Like, it's not like you've got, it's not like you got tapeworms in your brain or something, but it is instantly a day ruiner. That is a thing that ruins. I mean, that just puts a black mark. It just besmirches your entire day.
By the way, for those listeners who are keeping score, we go on the air for Legion of News at noon. Rick Emerson left his house at 11:45.
But I do that as a general rule because I do my prep at home.
Yeah, but then if something happens, you're even more late.
Well, but
as it is, I'm already a little bit nervous when I look and it's 5 minutes to air and you're not here.
But I got to say, out of 200 shows, I got to say I've been late twice. Once I was actually very late. But I mean, that's one half of 1%. I'm just saying, it has less to do with me being late than the fact that, like, I pull out of my driveway because I wouldn't have had time to get the flat tire taken care of anyway. It's still a morning ruiner because I'm just there by the side of the road looking at their coconut. Really, for the love of... Because now... And I live not too far from a Les Schwab, where they will, in fact, fix your tire for free. But now it's that whole thing of, can I drive, like, the three blocks to the Les Schwab on this essentially flat tire without destroying the wheel rim? And I honestly don't know the answer to that. Because it's not like you can just go and just jam it full of that fix-a-flat crap. Because then when they go to fix your car, they go, this doesn't have that fix-a-flat stuff on it, do you? And it's like, if you say yes, then they'll go, well, I'm sorry, we can't. So then I have to lie. because otherwise they won't fix the tire. And I don't like lying to the Les Schwab guys because they're nice. But I have to go, no, it doesn't. And then they go to fix it and immediately, like silly string sprays out of the thing like a bunch of foam snakes. And then they look over at me and give me the hairy eyeball. And then it's like I have to put Lara in the jackpot, as they say. I have to go, my wife. Well, women and cars. Boy, I told her not to do it. What do you know, ladies? And so to avoid that whole just mess of deception, to avoid just turning their entire thing into a house of fraud, I then have to figure out whether I can drive. Because I did that once with my old my Ford Escort years and years and years ago. I decided to drive to get the because I didn't want to pay to get it towed. And, of course, I can't change the tire. So I had to drive the car to the other side of town, to the Les Schwab place. And so I ended up driving this car on a completely flat tire for literally like 4.5 miles. And just, I got there, and it's like the wheel rim was just, it was like I was just driving on a pizza. It was just so, and the guy just looked up at me. And I think I actually just drove into the Les Schwab place. And I think I had actually driven so far on it that it had, like, cut through the tire or whatever. And I pull into the place, and I lean out the window, and I kind of point down at the tire. It was on the front driver's side. I point down at it, and before I even have a chance to say anything, the guy just looks at me and goes, no. So, all right.
Can you...
By the way, Seamus says, I don't even have a wife, and I blame things on the wife to strangers all the time. Well done, sir. All right. Anyway, so I get to go with my tire fixed this afternoon. That'll be a lot of fun. Oh, but so anyway, but the good news, though, is much as I'm obliged to throw her under the bus, like at a moment's notice, like at the drop of a hat, I will blame Lara for things that she has never, ever, things for which she has no responsibility. The reason why I was not late, though, is because she's in Beemore, so I was able to take the car back home and drive her car here. So, the morning's emasculation continued further as I was driving like a station wagon to work. So that was a lot of fun. How was your morning, Dawn? You racist?
Yes, that's my story. Here's the story about that, because I did mention that before. And I did wonder whether or not I should tell this story, and I realized that's what we're here for, you know, humiliating myself.
Yes.
There is a fellow who is staked out on the Ross Island Bridge when you get off I-5. Coming into town here, coming north. And he's there every morning, and he has a dog. He has a beautiful boxer, brown and white boxer.
I know exactly who you're talking
about. Yeah. And sometimes he has a lady friend with him, a blonde woman, who will stand there and hold the sign.
I know the guy you're talking about because I was on the phone with Lara the other day, and I drove by that guy, and for a minute it looked like he had his dog dressed up in a Superman cape. And it turns out it was actually just one of those, like, ponchos that people put on their dogs to protect from the rain. But I was like, oh my God, there's a guy, his dog is a superhero, he's got a cape! And I was going to give him money for that almost, and then I saw it was just a poncho, and so I did not. I know that guy.
Okay, so now, you know, you get that thing in your head where when you do the same thing day after day, you kind of get used to seeing the same thing, and it just registers in your brain.
Yes.
You know, there's the blue house, there's the store, there's the fire hydrant, there's the guy with the dog.
Right.
And then if something is different and you're not really looking, your brain just kind of flashes whatever the first thing is that it thinks it sees.
The periphery has changed.
Yeah. So I'm going there today, and this morning, instead of the guy standing there with the dog, the woman is standing there with the sign. And the guy is, if I have not mentioned this before, he's an African-American gentleman. He has dark brown skin. He was wearing a blue...
So he's really African-American.
He is. He really is. He's wearing a blue hoodie sweatshirt. But he's up on the railing of the thing off of, you know, like the...
It's like an island.
The guard... Yeah,
between
it's on an
two
island.
Lanes.
And then there's like a pole and a kind of a guard railing
right
thing. And he's on the guardrail thing, and as I realize a second later, when I realize what I'm looking at, he's lying on his side, like kind of propped up on one elbow.
Right.
So all I see is I see the woman. I don't see the dog at first. I just see the woman, and I see over her shoulder a figure that looks to be about 2.5 feet high, perched on a railing. And my first thought was, it's somebody with a monkey. And I said that to Patrick. I said, wow. Oh my God, I thought that the woman had a monkey. And he looked at me and I said, well, not because he's black, just because he looked like a monkey.
Because you saw a small, what appeared to be a smallish, dark-complected entity.
Yes. Like
perched next to her like a parrot.
Yes. Yes. And but then as soon as I said it, I realized what it sounded like.
Were you
like.
Trying to suck the words back into your mouth? Oh, she's got a monkey.
Yes.
No.
As soon as I said to Patrick, he's like, oh, my God, I thought she had a monkey. And then he just looked at me like, really, Don? You think the black man is a monkey?
Wow.
And I was like, no, because I couldn't see his whole body. I just because he was little.
I feel like we need to have a black man in the studio to make it okay to say these things. Because here's the thing. That reminds me of a story. Which will maybe make you feel better about yourself. Maybe not. Someone says, you need to call Keelan and demand that Don seek forgiveness from him on behalf of his people. He should issue some sort of a forgiveness certificate. I forgive you, Whitey. Someone says, wow. Two people have said essentially the same thing now. Two people have said, I was listening, and I didn't see that coming, no matter how hard I concentrated on figuring out the ending. Okay. Well, I mean, now was he moving or was, in other words,
no.
Was he totally stationary?
Yes.
Okay, but so it wasn't like, I'm trying to figure out exactly why you determined that it was, why you went right to that instead of like, she's next to a backpack that is dark colored.
I think it's because, first of all, if you see a person by the side of the road and they have another small creature with them, it is almost always a dog.
Yes.
But
so you assume she would have an animal of some kind.
But in this case, it was something with a human-looking face, and it was up on a railing. And the way he was laying with his elbow, because he was turned this way,
yes.
And I saw the elbow, so I just saw his head, and he had the hoodie up. He had the hood of his sweatshirt up.
Were you thinking it was a monkey wearing a sweatshirt?
I don't know what I thought. I just immediately went, is that a monkey?
It was an instinctive thing. You didn't really analyze it. It was a
maybe it's
gut response.
Everywhere I go, I'm always looking for monkeys. That could be it, too.
What do you mean by that?
I'm just hoping to see monkeys because I like them. I don't know. But it was, I swear, it was just that thing where, it's a thing where your brain just kind of like sees something that it hasn't, before it quite figures out what
right.
it is, it makes some association sometimes.
Well, that is, in fact, now, in your defense, I will say that, so I'm reading this book by Taylor Clark called Nerve, which is all about your brain's reaction to and processing of fear. And they talk about how your frontal cortex analyzes things and breaks down a situation logically. But that happens long after the fear reaction, or the because your amygdala is the first thing to respond. The amygdala is like, he describes it as being like a security system around your brain. It's your brain's alarm system, which is designed by evolution to keep you alive. And so the first thing the amygdala notices is just, he said the amygdala is like a really, really hyper-vigilant security guard with really bad vision. And so it doesn't really suss out details. It just notices the big block images and if something is different, if something has altered. So it notices contrasts in colors. It notices movements. And that is a holdover from when we were just, you know, sort of like sharing the wilderness with a lot of things that wanted to kill us. And you needed to be able to notice any kind of movement at all or anything that looked like it was not there yesterday or it wasn't there when I came this way. Now that I'm on my way back to the village, there's something different. And so you register all of these reactions like in a split second before the rest of your brain has time to go, but what is it really that I'm looking at? Because all your amygdala does is go like, could be a lion! And that's basically all it is. So you do notice things and your brain jumps to all kinds of associative and visual assumptions without having the entire picture, before it has all the information. So you would have noticed, you noticed her, you then noticed that there was a smallish living something next to her, which you automatically then, based on your prior experience, this is all the stuff that that he would say if he were here, the author, Taylor Clark, he would say that then, based on your previous experience, your brain immediately sorted out, okay, there's a woman, there's something next to her that looks alive, but it's small. It is probably an animal, because that is what you see homeless people with. If you see a homeless person with something small and alive, it's not usually a child. It's not usually a black man or hidden behind a railing.
Right.
I mean, not always. It is usually an animal. What is a small animal that would be perched next to her that might have, vaguely humanoid features?
It would have a brown primate face.
And vaguely humanoid features.
Yes.
It would be a primate of some kind. And then you went... It's Clyde from Any Which Way But Loose.
Yes.
But in fact, it was a black man.
No, and then it was a monkey.
Yeah, okay. But I can understand why your brain did that. I mean, I also understand the awkwardness, but... Okay. All right.
So now I feel really bad now, too, because every day now I'm going to drive by that guy and I'm going to think, I'm so ashamed. I thought you were a monkey. I'm going to think that every morning on my way to work.
You should give him money for that. You should stop by and just go, like, a little bit of, like, reparations of the soul.
I'm sorry. I'm not going to tell you why. I'm just sorry.
This was a friend of mine. I won't name him, but I almost feel like I can't tell the story now because then it's going to be two of these back to back, and it's just going to sound like it's Klan hour. I really don't. Someone says, please tell me the black guy heard Dawn. Please tell us yes, even if he didn't.
I hope he didn't read my lips.
Were the windows rolled up?
Yes.
I wonder if he was just thinking, that Yeti has a really human-looking face. Oh my God. Look at that Sasquatch over there. It's amazing. It almost looks human. Hey, there's a dead guy in front of Powell's.
Really?
Oh, I wonder what it looks like.
Find out about that.
It looks like a coral snake. All right. Okay. I don't know why. Apparently, they're on the scene with that. Looks to be apparently a homeless guy.
Oh.
Although, you know, here's the thing. I'm doing a you thing. I'm making that assumption. Yeah. Dead guy on the sidewalk in front of Powell's, and I'm going,
it
homeless?
It could be a businessman having a heart attack. It could be an author who discovered that there were no copies of his book to be found.
I have no further information here. Apparently, there is a he's not homeless anymore. That's right. He is in God's house now, or perhaps an urn.
So home.
There you go. So that's I don't even. Someone says, "Come on and share the story, Raso." Okay, I will say, and then I'm going to apologize in advance, and then probably halfway through, and then at the end, I'll apologize again. God, I hope that Justin Stanley, who's our guest today, I hope he isn't listening. I think he's very progressive. I hope he's not, he's like an NPR type. I hope he's not hearing the show right now. Or in the kitchen, just texting, hearing most racist show in the world. Apparently, I am guest in a few moments. Apparently there is a, someone says, I have a reporter, by which I think they mean a guy they work with, on location at Powell's. They're going to get more information on the dead guy. No, I... So, a friend of mine, and I will say, to the best of my knowledge, and who knows, one never knows what lurks in the heart of your fellow man. I will say, to the best of my knowledge, this friend of mine, a guy, and I will even, he's a guy, I used to live with this guy, he was years ago, he was at the House of Dudes, he was one of my roommates there. I will say that I believe in my heart that he is not a racist person, and I take him at his word when he says that this was as you did this morning with the, oh hey, look over there, it seems to be, you know, it... I take him at his word when he says that this was just a thought that popped into his head and escaped from his mouth before he had time to really actively consider what it would sound like out, like, in the cold, hard world. So you are familiar with the actor Yaphet Kotto?
Yes.
From Alien, and he was also in Homicide: Life in the Street, where he played Lieutenant Al Giardello. So my friend was a big fan of Homicide: Life on the Street, and we were watching Homicide one night, and it was like it was on NBC or something, or on A&E, whatever channel it was on, and I don't even remember the context that. I don't remember how this was led up to. I think I was like halfway through an episode of Homicide. And he walked into the room. And, I mean, one has to say, first of all, that Yaphet Kotto is, I mean, he's an imposing figure.
Yes.
I mean, he's a very large, very burly sort of, you know, and he's a very intense looking individual anyway. So my friend, though, I almost said his name, but my friend walked into the room where I was watching Homicide, and he was a huge Homicide fan, big fan of Yaphet Kotto. And he walked in, I'm sitting on the couch, and he walks in behind me, and he goes, boy, you know, Yaphet Kotto just looks like a big gorilla. It's that you hear that phrase, like, you know, the air sucked out of the room. And I didn't even turn. I just sort of, like, my mouth opened, like, sort of a... you know, and I turned, and as I turned, he hadn't even said anything. Before he even said anything, he was already doing that, like, jazz hands thing of, like, waving his hands in front of him, like, no, 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 I didn't mean, you know, and, like, there was no one else in the room. It was just me and this other white guy. And he then, like, for the rest of the day, like, he would occasionally just come back downstairs, and he would go, I meant that his nose is sort of broad and, you know, and more flat than, 'cause, you know, and then... Never mind. And then he would go back. And then, like, later on, You know, it's just that really the squarish shape of his head. I mean, really, if you didn't, like, no matter what color he was, like, even if he were a snow ape, I mean, I just, he's, goodbye, and then he would go back upstairs. And, like, for the, I think for the rest of the week, he would, and then he did the worst possible thing, and then I think he let it drop forever. He did the worst possible thing, though, and it's like, it's not like I was offended as such, because I sort of, as with you, I understand where his, I understand why he said it, I guess, from his explanation, that he wasn't trying to be racist. But I think he was trying to just sort of like buttress his own mental fortress in that regard, like his own self-image. Like he was trying to, and like he wanted to make absolutely sure that no one anywhere thought that he would actually just say that in some race-baiting way. And so he made the worst possible tactical maneuver on that front, though, which is to, later on that week, in front of someone who wasn't there and had never witnessed him saying it, he then explained what he had said and then tried to justify it to them. Like, they weren't even aware. Like, I was the only one who had ever heard it, and I was just not like I was going to go around telling people. Guess what my roommate said the other day? It was hysterical. I wasn't ever going to tell anybody until now, apparently. But then he brought it up to, like, somebody who wasn't there, and he goes, so the funniest thing happened the other day. So there's this thing where I said that Negro actor Yaphet Kotto looked like an ape. But what I meant was, and immediately you could see in the other person's face, like there was, they did the same thing I did, and you saw right away that he realized it was, he should not have tried to make anything better by telling other people the same story and then trying to anecdote his way out of it.
Well, it's interesting, though, because we have that thing where we are aware that in the past there have been those who have compared black people to monkeys. So therefore,
you are hypersensitive being that guy.
But the thing is, all of us are descended from apes.
It is true.
So we do have somewhat similar facial features, etc. But it's like, so on the one hand, you could not say, for example, you know, that Michael Kirk Duncan reminds me of a big gorilla, even though he's very dark of skin, of color, as are gorillas.
But you could say, that Andre the Giant.
Yeah. You could say, that Ron Perlman, he looks like a big silverback ape.
Totally.
And no one would think you were being racist.
Everybody would go, that's exactly true. You have really nailed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're right. No, but it is one of those, you know what it is? It's just one of those things that racists have ruined for the rest of us. It's a piece of the language or piece of observationalism that racists have ruined for everyone. Not unlike, I don't want to uncork a whole thing here. But, you know, but they're
that
all...
That and the phrase yard yuggins.
And there are... Well, what was it you said last year that I thought was racist, and it turns out that it really isn't? Was it lawn jockey?
Yeah, lawn jockey.
That, see, I believed to be... And here's the thing, and so this is like layers of stupidity. I was sort of taken aback because... Apparently, because he's even dumber than I am, my dad used to use that as a slur.
Wow.
My dad used the word...
He would call black people lawn jockeys?
Because I think... But here's the thing. It's the opposite of the way it should have been. Like, he didn't use it for black people because he thought it was fine. He used it because he thought it was hateful. And then I went to apply for that job. But wouldn't you know it, there's this lawn jockey in line ahead of me. He'll probably get the job because of that.
It's those bastard garden gnomes. They're destroying it for all us white people.
And so I grew up hearing him use the phrase lawn jockey as a slur, but that in and of itself, that right there, I think, is a case study in how language works. So it is a perfectly, apparently, innocuous phrase, but because my jackass bigot father used it, in my head, I immediately, and that shows exactly what that is, the whole thing we all know about the power of language and how they can be sullied by their usage and whatever. I can never really use that phrase without cringing, even after last year when I found that it's not a slur, because I was raised to think it was. So, you know, and it's like that whole thing of like, the tiger, is it Sambo and the
Sambo.
Tiger?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, one of those things that I think, was originally in India, but then and then became like this sort of... So that is a thing that has been taken away, a story that has been taken away by racists. See also Uncle Tom's Cabin, which has been ruined by racists. So it's like, you know, it's just... they destroy everything, Dawn, including your observation.
Dr. Doolittle? They ruined Dr. Doolittle. No, wait.
And your ability to make Marlon Perkins-like observations during the morning commute.
Yes, exactly.
Someone says, no, lawn jockeys are Mexicans. Stop. Just stop. Stop it now. Okay, now there's a whole debate going about weather lawn jockey is racist. We're stopping
it's
this.
It's not.
Now.
It's a description of a particular kind of a lawn ornament.
I don't know.
That traditionally were black, but you can actually buy white ones too. Yeah. People still buy them and use them.
Here's a funny thing. Before the show, completely unrelated to jockeys of any kind. Totally, and then we got to take a break. We got a guest coming up in like 12 minutes. She's going to just come in and hear us going. And then the word niggardly. What's up with that? Totally separate from all of this, before the show today, I was mentioning author Jim Goad, who is he's a Portland author, most famous for this book called The Redneck Manifesto, which is quite good, which I think you would enjoy a lot. The terrible title, which he himself did not pick, the Redneck Manifesto was named that by his publisher over his objections, but it is this great, great book of essays about the class divide in America, because he has this. His whole premise is that the gap between rich and poor is greater than the gap between black and white, men and women, you know, whatever, gay and straight. He also did this zine, this infamous zine called Answer Me, for which he was, I think, nearly charged with obscenity. But anyway, so I was talking about Jim Goad. So while we were gearing up to tell the, while I was gearing up to tell the story about my roommate and Yaphet Kotto, somebody types, not Chicky Green types, "What's next, Jim Goad?" And then moments later, "Oh my God, you did live with Jim Goad!" Because Jim Goad has a lot of race-tinged observations and comedy and so forth. Someone else who I will not identify says, "Hey, my ex totally banged Jim Goad, slut." All right. Okay, well, we're ending this part of the show now because it's just things are going really, really, really off the rails. I mean, they're really tempting to... Tempted to get beyond my control altogether. So we mentioned headlines, right?
Yes, we did.
Okay. Nazi Watch, which I think is redundant at this point. Monkey Watch, ditto. Cannibal Watch, that's really the only safe place we can go now. Plus, in an embarrassingly short time frame, we'll have Justin Stanley in the studio. He's going to talk about the Uprise Books Project. That'll be here in just a few moments, and so forth. Okay.
All right.
Well, let's do this. Let's do a couple of news stories just to sort of cleanse our palate, and we'll take a break. We'll come back with Mr. Justin Stanley at the news desk. Ladies and gentlefolk, please make way. This is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Two people in Scotland have been taken to the hospital following the world's hottest chili competition at an Edinburgh Indian restaurant. Emergency services were called to the Kismut restaurant in St. Leonard Street on Saturday afternoon after some competitors became very unwell. The competition involves people eating the Kismut Killer Curry. The Scottish Ambulance Service is now calling for a review into how the event is managed. On the restaurant's website, it insists the participants sign a legal disclaimer before taking part in the competition, which raises money for a Scottish children's charity. It is understood that members of the British Red Cross were on hand at the event, but the Scottish Ambulance Service still had to be called because two people had such a violent reaction. Curie Kim, 21, an American student on an exchange to Edinburgh University, said she decided to enter the challenge when she saw it advertised in the restaurant. She told BBC Scotland's news website, "It was very painful, and it felt like I was being chainsawed in the stomach with hot sauce."
I don't know how you're chainsawed with hot sauce, but I like the imagery.
"I have learned my lesson and will never do it again, and in fact, I will be cutting down on my spice intake." Ms. Kim came second in the contest. The woman who won ate the last bowl in 4 seconds and then ran outside to be sick, whereas I didn't, so I've learned I should have had a game plan like that, she said.
No, we figured exactly what... Did something go wrong or did something just go right here?
Well, I think something just went very, very right, really.
Because it's the... What is it? What's it called with
like
the food?
It's like world hottest chili, and it's called their... It's their Kismut Killer curry.
Okay.
So it's like some insanely hot curry, and they signed a legal disclaimer.
So it's not like you're rating various types of curry.
No.
It's just one type. Like, this is the hottest curry.
I think it's like the Salvador Mali's...
okay, the balls of fire
balls
thing.
Balls of fire time, yeah. Said there were three rounds, and I managed half of the last bowl. I was in so much pain, I wasn't aware of what was going on around me, and when I got to the hospital, they gave me medicine for the indigestion. I don't think the restaurant should do it anymore, as I think there are a lot less painful ways to raise money for charity.
Yes.
Organizer Abdul Ali said, "The British Red Cross we had on board could not cope we put our hands up. We did have to call the emergency services for a couple of our participants.
Wait, Curry will clean you out too. Let me tell you, that'll just that'll hose you out like nobody's business.
Yes, the Scottish Ambulance Service later said, we would urge the organizers to review the way in which this event is managed in the future to avoid another situation where emergency ambulances are required to treat their customers.
Seriously. Well, I mean, it seems like everybody was given a heads up. I mean, if something is called, first of all, curry itself is not like, it's not like that's just a food you can be guzzling down all the time. And if it's the world's hottest curry, you are, and where did this take place?
In Scotland.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, I don't know if Scotland is really known for its curry dishes,
I don't
but
know if
still.
They're really prepared for that sort of thing.
I mean, yeah, it doesn't seem like that's a thing. I don't think you could really be gearing up for that in Scotland.
I enjoy hot food, and I'm pretty well versed in it. You do have to build up a tolerance over time, and I'm pretty good with hot food. And I make curry at home. I have a big bucket of red curry paste in the fridge at all times, and we will make our own curry. And the thing is, you know, one good tablespoon of that in a pan, making the curry.
You're good.
Yeah, I'm good. And if you add much more than that, it's like even I just start going, okay, whoa, that hurts.
Now, what is the active spice in curry? Is it just red peppers?
It's a combination of things. It's turmeric and different curries have different combinations of spices. Curry is actually a mix, and it's like cumin and turmeric, and yeah, there's chili powder, different chilies powders in it.
Yeah, the hottest thing, the worst I ever got bitten by some bad food was a curry dish at a Thai place where I've told the story before. I was just mouthing off and give me the hottest you've got, and I was just being like a macho jerk about it. And they brought me this food that just, I mean, I thought I was going to die. I thought I was going to hyperventilate. And there are cases of people doing that where it gives you some like respiratory failure because your body just overloads from the shock of it.
Yeah, I did that at a Thai place here in Portland because I lived here in Portland probably about 5 years and had gotten used to the fact that like
nothing was spicy. Yeah.
And I was at a Thai place on Northwest 23rd, I think. And they said, do you want the spicy? Do you want the mild? Do you want the meat? And I was like, no, just give me the spicy. They're sure? And I was like, yeah, I'm sure. And they brought it. And I was like, I have blisters in my face.
Totally. Yeah.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah, I remember. It was that thing.
I can't even taste this.
And we're like, I was like, the top of my head was sweating, you know, and then you're just sitting there. And then for hours later, you just feel, and it just feels like all of your insides are staging a revolutionary war of some kind. Like they're trying to escape from the inside of your body. Like there's just a, you know, like there's like a Haymarket riot happening just like inside your colon.
Yes.
It's exactly like that. That's exactly what it sounds
like. Or like you're being chainsawed in the stomach by hot sauce, as that woman said.
Okay. Let's do one more and then we'll
Okay,
break
well,
here.
Let's do the Nazi watch. Let's get that out of the way.
Are we just going to like make it all just as part of a segment here?
Let's just do it.
Make it of a piece. Here's your Nazi watch for Wednesday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Germany has reportedly reopened hundreds of investigations of Nazi death camp guards following the May conviction of 91-year-old John Demjanjuk, who was found guilty of 28,060 counts of accessory to murder for his role as a guard at Poland's Sobibór camp during World War II.
The pronunciation you're looking for is Demjanjuk.
Demjanjuk? Is
yes.
that it?
Yeah.
Okay. The I like Demjanjuk. It's so much more evocative.
It is one of those words that doesn't look anything at all like it sounds. Yeah, and it does.
Stupid
and
Germans.
And Demjanjuk does sound like a lot angry. Yeah. It sounds like that the way it ought to be
so
pronounced.
So it's Demjanjuk.
Demjanjuk.
Okay. The Guardian reports that German authorities believe Demjanjuk's conviction and 5-year sentence sets a precedent for other war criminals because it was the first time that prosecutors were able to convict someone in a Nazi-era case without direct evidence that the person participated in a specific murder. Although Demjanjuk is appealing the decision, the head of the German prosecutor's office, Kurt Schrimm, said the authorities would not wait for Demjanjuk's appeal process to finish. He told the Associated Press, "We don't want to wait too long, so we've already begun." Well, I mean, they're in their 90s. Of course, you don't want to wait too long. So we've already begun our investigations. Although there are no statute of limitations for murder and related offenses in Germany, the youngest of the suspects is in his 80s.
Yeah, no, you got to get him on trial like before this afternoon is up.
Ephraim Zuroff, the Simon Wiesenthal Center's chief Nazi hunter, added that Demjanjuk's conviction has opened the door to prosecutions that were never thought possible. He told The Guardian, "It could be a very interesting final chapter. This has tremendous implications even at this late date." And he speculated that ultimately about 40 former guards could eventually be brought to trial.
See, and a lot of people say that it's a waste of money because they're 90, but I sort of like the symbolism of it, of just coming and like kicking down the door to the old folks' home, you know, and just right as they're like playing shuffleboard or at the ice cream social and just handcuffing and just tasing them right there. Just
oh, you thought you were safe, did
you? Yeah, ya? Just sort of a, you, yeah, sort of a, you are never, like, the long arm of the law will find you wherever you are. The, I don't know why this reminds me of this. When I lived in Utah, I had a friend of mine who was very skilled at, he was a graphic artist. He was very skilled at the use of Photoshop. And just, like, to amuse himself, I think, there was no real reason for it. Like, the unwitting participant in this was actually a really nice guy. But he, in Photoshop, he took one of the local TV weather guys and, like, Photoshopped him. He de-zelliged him, Photoshopped him into, like an SS rally. So, like, all these guys in the black SS suits, like, doing the Hitler salute, you know, like, while Adolf Hitler's speaking. And then in the background is like so-and-so, like the local CBS weather guy. So he Photoshopped him into a Nazi rally. It looked absolutely convincing. And then he put it on the internet, and then he called the station and screamed at them about it and said he was horribly offended. I just found, and he was putting on his old guy voice. He's like, I just found out that you employ a Nazi war criminal. What kind of a weatherman is he? And he refused to be mollified. The person at CBS was just going, well, you know, the local CBS was going, well, okay, but now this photo appears to be very, very old. World War II was in 1944 or so, and. Now and our weather person, Mr. Smith, you know, he's only 29. So how is it? Well, he's very clever, and he would just and I don't know why. There's just something, and so now whenever I see pictures of like a Nazi rally or Hitler speaking, I always expect this weather guy from Utah to be in the background. And he found the greatest, because he's like very Mormon and very, you know, whatever. And he had just had the biggest beaming smile on his face, like he was the happiest little Nazi. All right. Let's end this now. Yeah. There's your Nazi watch for...
Okay.
Sorry about everything. You have successfully raised the bar, though. You've demonstrated there are bigger racists.
Yes. See?
I mean, you're no Auschwitz death guard.
No. No, we can say that...
Definitively.
Definitively.
All right. Okay, then. Let's take a break, shall we? We'll come back after this with Mr. Justin Stanley from the Uprise Book Project and more, including your Cannibal Watch and, I don't know, Don Taylor may give you a brief overview of last night's Sons of Anarchy. That'll probably be tomorrow.
Nope.
But don't forget, not even a brief overview. You get nothing and like it. Okay, never mind. Come back and you'll just suck that. That's what you'll do.
Ain't happening. Nope. My lips are sealed.
Coming up this afternoon at 4 p.m., don't forget you can hear Don Taylor with Bobby Fireboy Roberts at Cascadia.fm for Hamfisted Radio. That is at 4 p.m. Pacific time, and you can get it later at hamfistedradio.com. Hey, is Aaron Duran going to be on this week?
No, he is not.
All right, screw him.
Andrew Hill of Caveman Medicine is going to be on, and we are going to be talking about physical ailments and massage and that sort of thing. And in case you are available and want to come and listen, we are going to be doing an exciting contest where you, yes, you, might win a free treatment, a free massage from Mr. Hill.
Excellent. So. That is 4 p.m. today at Cascadia.fm. Stay there. We're back after this. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to The Rick Emerson Show. This is the Emerson News Network.
You've been making your brags around town, that you've been loving my man. But the man I love, when he picks up trash, he puts it in a garbage can. And that's what you look like to me, and what I see is a pity. You better close your face and stay out of my way if you don't want to go to Fifth City. You better detour around my town, 'cause I'll grab you by the hair of the head and I'll lift you off of the ground. I'm not a saying my baby's a saint, 'cause he ain't, and that he won't pat around with a kitty. I'm here to tell you, gotta lay off of my man if you don't wanna go to Fifth City. Come on and tell me what you told my friends, if you think you're brave enough. And I'll show you what a real woman is, since you think you're a hot stuff. You'll bite off more than you can chew if you get too cute or witty. You better move your feet if you don't want to eat a a meal that's Coffee City. If you don't want to go to Fish City, you better detour around my town. Cause I'll grab you by the hair of the head, and I'll lift you off of the ground. I'm not a send my babies a saint, cause he ain't that he won't pat around with a kitty. I'm here to tell you, gotta lay off of my man if you don't want to go to Fish City. I'm here to tell you, gotta lay off of my man if you don't want to.
You're listening to The Rick Emerson Show. This is the Emerson News Network.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. If you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. Don't know much about geography. Don't know much trigonometry. Don't know much about algebra. Don't know what a slide rule is for. But I do know one and one is two. And if this one could be with you, what a wonderful world this would be. Now, I don't claim to be an A student, but I'm trying to be. For maybe by being an A student, baby, I can win your love for me. Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. La ta 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 ta. History. Biology. Well, la ta 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 ta. Yeah, but I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Emerson Show. This is the Emerson News Network.
Here at the bar, who cares what I do? I'm all alone, but I'm drinking for two. Drowning the man that I used to be. Nobody loves you like me. I won't sign a thing, or else if I do, I'll use a pencil and that will show you. How nothing lasts, how nothing is free. Nobody loves you like me. I shouldn't stay, I think you'll agree. It's no good for you, no better for me. In the morning I'll go to a place far away, somewhere you'll never find. I catch a look, a thing that you say. Out on the fire escape, smoking all day. Missing someone, now who could it be? Nobody loves you like me. Noises outside, the trucks in the street will cover my flight, my hero's retreat. I'm supposed to feel bad, but I don't anymore. Only when you remind me. Air in my lungs, a cough and a wheeze,
holes in the bellows and blood on the keys. You move along, there's nothing to see. Nobody loves you like me. Nobody loves you like me.
You're listening to The Rick Emerson Show. This is the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us on this Wednesday. It is 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick at rickemerson.com. That is rick at rickemerson.com. Or, pardon me, Dawn at rickemerson.com. You can also get at us via text box if you like, or Skype. It's Rick Emerson Show, all one word, via Skype, and so forth. Still to come today, we got, let's see, we have your Cannibal Watch coming up, and I think almost everything, because we derailed ourselves like 12 seconds into the show. So, in mere moments, we'll be joined by Mr. Justin Stanley. There was one other thing I wanted to mention. Wait. Ah, tomorrow. Tomorrow, we're going to be joined in studio by our good friend Hoyt, I think is what we've...
Yes, Hoyt.
I think it was his request that we identify him as Hoyt. So, he works in the call center for what we will describe for the purposes of this program as a major online gaming console for their online service. The online component of a prominent gaming console.
Okay.
He works at their support center.
All right.
So that. Anyway.
Let you try to figure it out for yourself, because we're not telling you.
Yeah, so that'll be tomorrow. And then Friday, another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 with Mr. Big Jim Willig. That's what is coming up for the rest of the week. Our next guest is the founder of the Uprise Books Project, a nonprofit whose goal is to get banned and challenged books into the hands of young readers, especially those who might not otherwise have the financial means to experience some of the more provocative works in the world of literature. You can find out more about this, by the way, by going to uprisebooks.org. That's how you can do that. It's the Uprise Books Project at uprisebooks.org. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Radio Program, Mr. Justin Stanley. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am fantabulous. First of all, so there was this great moment where you came into the studio. Here's the other thing, by the way. Now, I have no idea. You have a sort of ageless quality to you, which I mean in the best possible way. I'm just saying you look neither young nor old. You just seem to be a man displaced in space and time. But you look astonishingly like the younger version of one of my uncles that was in my home growing up. My mom had this this picture of her family, and one of the pictures was her brother, one of her brothers when he was, I don't know, in his mid-20s or something. But he looked like a lot of people did in olden times. He just looked very unhappy to have his photo taken, like he was just sort of glowering a lot. And so he just looked down very sternly from the wall of my childhood home every morning of my life. And so now it's like that painting is just sitting in the studio with me wearing a powder blue sweater. It's all very weird.
Well, I'm not disappointed in you if that
okay.
Helps
that's
at all.
Okay. I mean, at least that's the least creepy answer you could have given. I mean, if you had attempted like some sort of a menacing look right now, you know, then it might have actually just chilled me. But so you came in, you sat down, we were talking about introductions all around, and then it turns out that you and Dawn, who at first didn't know each other, actually secretly know each other. Dawn Taylor, please to explain.
Well, he knew that he knew me. And he said he was going to say something on Twitter about being here. And I said, well, my Twitter name is DawnTaylor666. And he said, oh, I know.
The DawnTaylor666?
I was like, oh, like you know that. And he said, well, no, I've been following you for some time. And I said, well, who are you? And he said, I'm Nerdliness on Twitter. And I went, oh, well, I know you. So, yeah, we've been reading each other on Twitter for ages.
Now, how is it you came to be following Don on Twitter?
I don't know. Probably just following somebody who followed Don and, you know, how these things sort of just grow organically. And the next thing you know, you're following somebody you have no connection to whatsoever in real life.
Now, here, let me just get completely off the point right away. Let me just squander your time even further by talking about Twitter. So do you guys do the thing of, like, when you – okay, so, like, if I'm following Don – and then there's somebody that you respond to or somebody that responds to you and I see it because it's you know, you're mentioned in it or whatever. Do you guys add a lot of people based on, like, secondhand stuff like that? You know, like somebody you're following, like they intersect with somebody? Like, what percentage of people you add on Twitter are because you saw them? Like, do you wait for people to add you, or do you proactively add people that you see interact with people that you're following?
For me, if I read something that's funny or interesting, you know, then I'll go ahead and just jump on it and give them a little trial run for a little while. And if they continue to entertain me, then I'll keep following them.
And does somebody now, if you stop following somebody on Twitter, unfollow them, do they know? Does it send them a thing saying, like, you know, Don has found you insufficiently amusing?
There are programs that you can go and download and that will track your Twitter traffic. And some people do that. Some people obsessively track how many people have followed them and if anybody's dropped them. And I don't want to know. I'd rather not know if somebody unfollows me, because then I'll start wondering what it was I did and why they left. So I'd really rather not know. As far as adding people, if somebody retweets something somebody said and it's especially clever, I'll go to their profile and I'll look at their recent tweets and I'll see what their timeline looks like and what sort of things they talk about. And if they seem really interesting or clever or funny, I will add them. I'll add people sometimes if they come up a lot as a friend of a friend, like, okay, you know, this is somebody that is sort of within the circle. And every once in a while, I'll add somebody famous that I think I want to read what they – but I don't add – on Facebook, I'll friend anybody who asks on Facebook. I'm completely egalitarian with Facebook. It's just fine. Twitter, I just want to read people that, you know, I find interesting. I mean, I still follow, I just pulled it up to look. I still follow 483 people on Twitter. Granted, many of those people don't tweet very often. But I, on the other hand, am followed by 925 people. So it's like, I don't add everybody back because I honestly don't care.
Well, in other words, and then it becomes just like the New York stock ticker, where it's like it's just impossible. I mean, it just flows in like the River Ganges. I mean, the faster they're going
to
be read.
And I'm too lazy to go through and set up groups of, like, you know, which you can do. You can say, these are all the people I know that are film critics, and these are all the people I know that are pop culture people, and these are all the people I know who are actual friends. And it's just, that's just too much work.
It's already all right. Even just thinking about it has overtaxed my feeble mental power.
Also, in other words, in other news, though, by the way, I have 925 followers. That means I need 75 more to hit my first milliwheaton.
Okay.
So,
is that the unit of measurement?
Yes, 1,000 followers is a milliwheaton.
Wait, so then a wheaton would be 1,000, which is how much?
Well, Wheaton was the very first celebrity on Twitter, I think it was, to hit something like 100,000 followers, and so they then designated 1,000 followers as a milliwheaton. Except he now has something like 2 million followers, so a milliwheaton is not actually an accurate measurement any longer.
So if 1,000 people is a milliwheaton, then that means a wheaton is 1 million followers.
Yeah.
So he actually now has 2 wheatons.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Justin, I forgot you were there.
Sure.
Well, look, you're called Nerdliness. You had to know this would happen.
Yes.
So let's talk about the Uprise Books Project. First and most obvious question. This is the you must get asked all the time, is why banned or challenged books? Why raise money for those?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of reasons. The first one is that we just don't abide by censorship. So we think that we follow the American Library Association's guidelines that say that minors have First Amendment rights, and that only a parent has the ability and the right and responsibility to control the access for their own individual child and not anybody else's. So we come into it from that. But most importantly, we think that using banned and challenged books with our target audience, teenagers, especially impoverished teens, is going to provide more of an incentive for them to actually read the books once we get them into their hands.
It's a little bit of a psychological jujitsu.
Yes, exactly.
Sort of, you know, the man doesn't want you to read The Great Gatsby. And then, you know, well, I'm going to read it. Fresh green breast of the new world.
Right.
Or whatever.
Exactly.
So the idea that the somewhat illicit nature of it might encourage them to read.
Yes, exactly. The same kid who might not be interested in a book that's at the top of the modern library's list might be a little more interested in reading a saucy tale filled with sex and violence.
A saucy tail. That's exactly how you should market it to them. Was there? Did you have a? Was it like a eureka moment? Some was there? You know, where you sat upright and you went, "My God, that's what I'll do." I mean, so, how did it occur to you?
Over the summer, I'm actually an MBA student on the side, in addition to working full time and all that fun, having a family and everything. So over the summer, I took a course over at PSU as part of the program that was a on social enterprise and entrepreneurship and innovation. And this sort of came out of a class project. It was originally intended to be a for-profit endeavor. And then it just became clear that it really didn't make sense with that model, that this was a nonprofit idea. But it was something that was resonating enough that I wanted to keep on with it after the class ended, and you know, just kind of got wheels of its own there.
And so you're using, like a lot of people do for things now, using Kickstarter to raise money for this. So where are you in terms of your goal?
We are at about 35% right now. With we're running it through the end of the month. So Halloween will be the last day. We are a little bit behind pace now. So we're hoping here that your listeners will help us get back on track. And then towards the end, most of the Kickstarter projects have a bit of a ramp at the end, like your typical NPR fund drive. Where the
what's the goal for it? What is it? What trying to hit
$10,000.
When people say this is a side issue, but it's a nonprofit, and I think sometimes people, I don't know, I think people hear a lot about one of the guys at NPR, like living in a $12 trillion house or whatever. When they hear nonprofit, I think sometimes there's nonprofit and there's profit and there's not for profit. What is it? You're a nonprofit, so what does that mean? When people donate money, I think they sometimes want to know that kind of stuff.
Sure. Yeah. Right now, we're still in the process of getting the IRS tax exempt public charity status, the 501c3 that would allow people to deduct their donations as from their taxes every year and that sort of a thing. We're recognized as a nonprofit corporation from the state, but that's just sort of, you automatically get that when you file with the, we're in the state of Washington in our case. So we filed the paperwork with the IRS, and we're in the hurry up and wait pattern, which generally takes about 90 days, assuming they don't find anything wrong with it. So we're about a month into that right now.
So your embezzlement has to been put on, you know, like at least three months or so before you can just start stashing it away.
Exactly, exactly.
What are the logistics of this? So you got 10 grand as your Kickstarter goal. Let's say, you know, you hit that, you've got it, you're ready to go to the next step. I mean, how far ahead is this planned out? I mean, is it, what happens then?
Sure. We have a couple of contingency plans, just because we, like you said, we don't really know for sure yet if we are going to be able to count on that 10 grand. And then even if we do hit the 10 grand exactly, the amount that we're going to see is going to vary depending on the mix of donations, because Kickstarter and then Amazon as their payment company take a percentage off the top of that. And then depending on which levels people have donated at will determine which rewards that we're going to send out to them. So, you know, if we end up with a bunch of small donations, we end up with more shipping costs than if we end up with, you know, if somebody calls in and gives us $5,000 right now.
Right.
Obviously, we have fewer to send out. So so we've been working with a couple of developers and designers to help lay out what that groundwork's going to look like under these different situations. And so depending on if we hit the target and we have the money, then we have, X, Y, and Z planned. If we don't do it, then we're going to have to still do things, but a little bit slower, and it's going to take a long time.
It's like, so, and is this going to be a regional thing? Is it going to start, in Clackamas County, or is it going to start in Clark County, and then expand out? But so you've got, let's say, you hit your goal, you've got your finances set, all of that, you're ready to actually begin.
Mm-hmm.
So there's you here, and then there's impoverished youths there, waiting for their Canterbury Tales or whatever. How does A get to Z?
Sure. So once we get the site up and running, our first step is going to be to touch base with a pilot group here that we can work with locally, find one of the local schools that qualifies for our program based on income requirements. So we'll be running through that locally at first, just to shake things out. Once we have everything up and running, then we will open up the whole thing to the entire U.S. Since with our model, we're going to be able to fulfill orders throughout the country without a problem. It's just going to be a matter of getting the word out.
Is it going to be from is it like a centralized, like a mail order thing, like Amazon, or is it going to be like the banned bookmobile that sort of rolls around?
Yeah, we're going to essentially use Amazon and other online retailers almost like drop shippers. So we're going to get these orders in from so the way that the site will work, the way that we're envisioning it, is that student A from rural Mississippi that wants a copy of The Color Purple, for instance, they're going to be able to go onto the site, browse through the list of banned and challenged books that we've pre-compiled, and add the ones that they're interested in to their own personal wish lists. At the same time, we'll use the site to solicit donations from people throughout the country that might be interested in helping kids from Mississippi, or women, or kids that are interested in books that were banned for homosexual content, or whatever it's important to them, right? So we'll help. They'll be able to browse through the lists of requests that are going to be anonymous enough to keep the kids safe, place the order for them, and then we'll fulfill that using Amazon or whatever the least expensive online retailer is, and then ship that order anonymously to the student.
Here's a weird question. Is this is it legal? I mean, can you give a book that's been challenged or banned to a 15-year-old?
They should be able to. There are some states that will have certain like, for instance, there was that book that was banned, challenged. It was an ebook about how to love children, basically.
Yes.
You know, right?
Yes.
So something like that that was in the state of Florida that did meet their or that was against the law in Florida.
Yeah,
so
it was actually ruled obscene or indecent or something. Yeah.
Exactly. So something like that, you know.
But a book that you could but a book that you could walk into the store and buy.
Oh yeah.
But that, like, schools have taken out and said kids can't read. Is it legal for this program to get to say, well, look, the school won't let you check it out, but
sure.
Here it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the reaction to this been so far? It seems, you know, a place like Portland, you know, or, you know, in Vancouver, you'd like to think that it would get a strong response. Has the reaction been pretty universally positive?
Yeah, we've had a couple of naysayers for various reasons, mostly because they just doubt that books are banned and challenged in the U.S. anymore, and they don't realize that these are happening in specific schools. And plus, they don't realize that a lot of the kids that we're talking about are going to be living in areas that don't have access to public libraries. Like, for instance, that was one of the first negative reactions we had was, you know, why can't they just go to the library and get it? And it's like, well, A, the library is where they're being banned
right.
from. And even if it isn't that library, they tend to live in underfunded neighborhoods that are further away from public libraries, so they don't have the physical.
People do not appreciate the library system in Portland, Oregon, for one thing. I'll tell you that. I lived in Salt Lake City, which is a place that is, you know, in Utah, is so family-centric, and it's mm-hmm. so predicated on children and on the family core and the family unit. But that is, I have, relative to the size of that city and to the amount of money that a lot of people in that city make, I mean, it's a wealthy city in a lot of ways. I have never seen, proportionally speaking, a more underfunded library system than when I lived in Salt Lake County. And I came to, when I moved here in 98, I mean, it was beautiful and just astonishing to see how fantastic the library system is here. It really, people sometimes do, they take for granted, I think, until they are in a place where you can't, you know, where you can't necessarily find libraries a lot, or they're in a place in their lives where they can't be buying a lot of books and they have to go to the library.
Right.
They don't appreciate, you know, what it's like to have ready access to those things. And if you live in some, and I was fortunate early on that I had a sister that provided me with books nonstop. Even before I could read. I mean, she was like giving me, like, you know, the books like as soon as I was born, you know, in preparation for when I was able to read. And people, if they don't have that, and if there isn't a library nearby, it's like a lot of times it's just, you know, and if you live in a family that doesn't put a lot of emphasis on it,
mm-hmm.
or in a family that sometimes they have their own ideas about what notions you should be exposed to.
Right.
It
Absolutely.
Can be very tricky.
Now, is there also the idea that kids might be more encouraged to seek out these books and read them simply because they're banned?
Yeah, absolutely. That forbidden fruit sort of angle. Yeah, we definitely think
they think they're going to read something naughty and then later don't even realize
right,
they learned
exactly.
something.
Damn it! Great Gatsby was a classic. You know, now I'm hooked and I've had this gateway drug that's going to lead to other, you know, good books. And some of them, you know, some of the books that we're talking about aren't necessarily classics. Like, you know, they might be the Captain Underpants books or something along those lines. But, you know, if a kid is in a position where that's their level, you know, that's their reading level, regardless of the fact that they're 17 and if they're reading at a 13-year-old level, then, you know, who cares? They're getting a book that's at their level, that's, you know, appropriate for them, and that's going to hopefully get them hooked on the idea of reading and moving on to something else later on.
Well, and that's one of those, you know, I was actually looking last night at the ALA's list of challenge books, not just for this last year, but for the last 10 years or whatever. And in a lot of the sort of, you know, the usual suspects are on there. You know, the Catcher in the Rye, and, you know, mm-hmm. and whatever, and The Color Purple, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and whatever, and Fahrenheit 451, which is hilarious. Just the idea that both 1984 and Fahrenheit 451 had been challenged or banned in certain places, and that here's a question: when somebody says challenged, I get what that means. That's usually where some just like group of blue hairs, you know, is just up in arms about something.
Right.
But when people say banned. I mean, what is that? Does flat out banning happen in the United States? And if so, by who? Is that a school, or is that where is banning happen?
Yeah, exactly. It's tends to happen in the schools itself. It does still happen. I mean, it recently happened. It's been overturned to a degree, but there was the high school in Missouri where Slaughterhouse-Five was banned,
really?
Along with a couple other books. Yeah, just a couple of months ago. I believe that they have overturned that, or at least made it somewhat available. And if I remember correctly, the person who actually was issuing the ban was a professor whose own children weren't actually attending the high school.
What was the complaint about Slaughterhouse? Was it language? Was because it's...
Yeah, I think it's language and it's blasphemous.
Well, go... Well, didn't we have... What was that book that a couple years ago, the Bunny Suicides?
Yeah.
Which is... I think they either took or were trying to take out of schools or something like that.
It's interesting that a number of the books that end up getting challenged or banned are books that aren't necessarily... It's because of language. It's not necessarily because of sexual content. It's simply because... The theme of the book is encouraging kids to fight the status quo.
Right. Yeah.
Because Robert Cormier's The Chocolate War ends up on these lists all the time. These books get challenged and banned. That book gets challenged and banned all the time. And it's a book that is just purely about a kid at a boys' school who stands up against the school,
right,
against the system.
You know, Shel Silverstein's had his books banned before for encouraging kids to sass their parents and break dishes.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's exactly that at all age levels.
I was looking at this list last night, and that is a common thread throughout a lot of banned books. It is the notion of not just accepting what you're spoon fed. Mm-hmm. And I've told the story so often that the tale has undoubtedly gone stale. But when I was 12 years old, at just a little roadside sort of, they called it an antique shop, but it was really just sort of a junk store. When I was around 12 years old, I was here to visit my grandparents with my mom, and she stopped at some roadside flea market or whatever, and I found just this tattered, beat up. I wish I still had it, but I think I have subsequently given that copy away to somebody. But I found this beat up, dog eared, tattered copy of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which. And I'd never seen the movie. I didn't see the movie, in fact, until many, many years later. But I kind of was familiar with the title, but I didn't really know what it was about. And it was like a cool picture of a guy in a straight jacket on the front. And I was like, well, this – and I was a voracious reader. And I was about to be done with my book. And it was like a quarter. And I bought it. And it just blew my mind. I mean, it just took my brain apart and just polished it and stuck it back together like better and faster than it was before. And it just – and I think I would be – I don't know that I would be – drastically different. I think I would be a markedly different person, I think, if I had not read One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which as I found out later is challenged and banned all the time because it's got some profanity and some very mild by today's standard sexual content, but more than anything else, but because Mick Murphy has no bones about just telling the man just to stick it. And so as we sort of I should say, by the way, as you get ready to wrap this up, you can find out more about this at uprisebooks.org. That's uprisebooks.org. Uprisebooks.org. A couple of questions for you. What was the banned book that most impacted you or most affected you?
I actually got reading later than I would have liked. So most of my, I think probably the one that got me really interested in the idea of banning books was Huck Finn. I mean, yeah. That's just it's still today. The whole whitewashing of it and wanting to clean up the clearly offensive language. I mean, there are words in it that, you know, people don't say, but it's the fact that at that time they did, and it is that ugliness that people need to remember, and that's the very reason why it should still remain the way it is.
More than anything else, I wish that science had progressed to the level where we could reanimate Mark Twain just long enough to just get him to weigh in on the whole thing. You know, just to ask him what he thinks about that. What is, and then in the overall, what is the first book you remember loving?
Clifford the Big Red Dog.
Awesome, that's a fantastic answer, Don Taylor. What is the? Do you have a banned book or a challenge book that is?
Well, actually, it's interesting to me because I had a sophomore English class that all of the like the high readers. We had like a sort of an interesting one level English class that was paired with a history class, and so you were basically reading about things. And then the history class you took sort of dovetailed with what you're reading in English. But over the course of that 1 year, we read Catcher in the Rye, Brave New World, and Slaughterhouse-Five.
Oh, wow.
As part of our reading assignments in that one class. And those are all three books that all of them are on the ALA banned book list.
I didn't know until I saw the list last night that Brave New World gets challenged. I had no idea. Yeah. I guess because maybe, and you know, not like I'm smarter than anybody else, but I guess I read it and I'm not offended by it or bothered by it. And so it occurs to me, you know, not at all that somebody else would be.
Right.
But... you can find out more about this at uprisebooks.org. That is uprisebooks.org. And we should give a shout out to to our good friend Chuck Palahniuk, who you said has mentioned it. He has given it, thrown his support behind it. So really good enough for Chuck, good enough for you, my friend. So that is uprisebooks.org, and that is through the end of this month that the campaign is going
that
on.
That is correct.
Awesome. So ladies and gentlemen, you can find out more about that at uprisebooks.org. Mr. Justin Stanley, thank you, my friend. Thank you for being in.
Thanks for having me in.
Yeah, and nerdliness on Twitter.
Nerdliness. Is that without and just as it sounds?
Yes, exactly. Although the one for this account is at Uprise Books.
All right. I have to add that as well.
Justin Stanley from uprisebooks.org. Thank you, sir. We're going to take another brief break back after this. Don't go anywhere. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Stay right there.
You're listening to The Rick Emerson Show. This is the Emerson News Network.
Here's to life.
You're listening to The Rick Emerson Show. This is the Emerson News Network.
They gave me a test to make me the best that I could be. They knew all along that there was something wrong with me. We picked out a spot and made a hole. Wire and glass and stainless steel. Now I can imagine how I feel. There's blood on the bed, but here in my head, I'm feeling fine. It's easy to sleep when I'm not buzzing all the time. So funny the way I was before. Once I was blind, but now I see. Once I was him, but now he's me.
You're listening to The Rick Emerson Show. This is the Emerson News Network.
Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. Yeah, don't forget, tomorrow we'll be joined by Hoyt, who does online support for a prominent gaming consoles call center. That's what we'll be doing tomorrow. Friday, Mr. Big Jim Willig will be in the studio with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. And coming up later this afternoon, 4 o'clock, Don Taylor at Cascadia.fm with Hamfisted Radio, later on at HamfistedRadio.com. And still later today, a new episode of FunEmploymentRadio.com around 6 p.m. or so. Hey!
And still later than that, I'll be going to bed and sleeping.
Is that true? Oh, how was, did you go to Geek Trivia last night?
Oh, no.
Okay.
I had a hard day yesterday, which I didn't really share because I was just sort of doing my best to
Was it caused by black men?
No, okay. It had nothing to do with black men.
All right.
Unless you consider my husband a black man, which you really wouldn't because he's very, very white.
Only certain parts of him.
You know what I mean. No, I had my quarterly emotional breakdown yesterday morning. Patrick said something to me in a rather harsh tone of voice, and I hadn't quite gotten out of bed yet, much less had coffee. And so I was like, shut up, it's not my fault. And I did that whole thing where I just went, everything is about you, it's nothing, my life sucks. And I just kind of freaked out, and I do that about...
Does once a month mean quarterly?
No, I only do it about every 3 months. I just sort of, it all builds up, and then I have sort of a meltdown, and it's done, usually. But the thing is, it hung over afterwards, and I just went into that thing where I was deeply, deeply depressed, and I came into work, and I just was like, it was everything I could do to just ramp myself up to, like, show mode, do the show, get everything done. But as soon as, like, it was over, and the mics were off, and you left... It was like I felt the cloud come back, and I just felt like crap again. And I just went home and was like, I'm depressed, I'm sad, I hate my life. And I had, like, you know, a bourbon and Coke, and then I took a hot bath, and then I watched some TV. And then, like, about 10:30 at night, I actually felt better. And that's when we played Settlers of Catan. And it was really weird. And so, but it was like, but Todd the Corpse had emailed me during the day while we were doing the show yesterday and said, are you going to go to Geektivia? Because he was on my team last time. And I just wrote back and said, no, depressed, not going to be able to do it. Took everything I could to just do Emerson. And then I said, the show, not the man. Don't say anything. And so, yeah, so I was just like, it's not going to happen. So, no, I did
no,
not.
No, you didn't go to Geektivia last night.
No, I didn't. I went home and put on pajamas and drank and moped, basically.
Okay, she's Dawn Taylor at the news desk.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
You didn't know this. So apparently Keelan just started listening.
Oh.
And we were making the observation about Patrick and his Patrick and his physique and his similarity to a black man. Keelan just typed all lowercase. Wow, only 2 days away from Dawn's Black Talk Friday. You have no idea, sir.
Oh,
I'll just let you download the show later.
You missed this morning. You should have been here this morning.
Sorry, he says, I had to run errands. Did I miss anything?
Yeah.
No.
No, nothing at all.
Nothing
no,
at all.
No, you were not needed at all.
I wouldn't worry about nothing interesting happened at the beginning of the show. No. I wouldn't worry about it at all. All right, here's Dawn Taylor.
With German roots and Bible Belt values, the North Alabama town of Cullman marked Oktoberfest for decades with Oompa Music, Lederhosen, and Bratwurst, but no beer. Now the party long billed as the world's only dry Oktoberfest is finally going wet. Organizers tapped a keg for the first time Monday at Cullman's Oktoberfest, ending an autumn prohibition in a town of 14,000 that had banned alcohol sales outright until church leaders lost that fight last fall. Hundreds of people sipped beer and cheered at a stein-hoisting contest Monday night. A blocked-off downtown street was full of people enjoying $4 drafts. A few men wore traditional German pants and socks. Couples washed down bratwurst and spicy pretzels with beer. In a compromise aimed partly at helping ease the concerns of townspeople who worried about adding booze to the party, there was still an alcohol-free side to the celebration located about 50 yards away under a big open shed.
Who would possibly go there? That is just like a leper lounge. Who would possibly go to that loser celebration?
Well, as it says here, according to the Associated Press, there, children did the chicken dance and cans of Pepsi sat on mostly empty tables.
Aww.
The crowd on the dry side was less than half as large as the crowd on the side that had
now,
beer.
Now, is there an explanation as to, I mean, was it just inertia that it took this long? Like it had always been dry
It had always been dry. The town was founded in 1873 by a German guy, so they've always had Oktoberfest. They actually had their first Oktoberfest in 1977 when a church staged it for their 100th anniversary celebration, but alcohol sales were illegal in that county, and so it had to be it had to be dry. In place of alcohol, they drank root beer, and organizers came up with their own sparkling apple cider called October Zest.
No. That's just...
So they added events like a car show and a beauty pageant over the years, but the event still stayed small. So everything changed late last year when voters decided to legalize alcohol sales in the city, despite the opposition of some local church leaders. With the measure backed by local business interests, citizens signed off on something they had shot down several times before, with some saying it was simply time for the town to move forward.
Look, it's not like I really sympathize with Germans ever about anything at all. But, I mean, an Oktoberfest where it's illegal to sell booze, I mean, that really almost justifies another invasion. That really, them just coming in and Berlin just taking over.
And some of the people at the Oktoberfest wore T-shirts that said, dreams really do come true, beer in Cullman.
Okay.
That's apparently been their dream, is to have beer.
You know, every now and again when you hear about some dry, like Monmouth, which was dry until a couple years ago, I mean, it really just... You just don't even consider that there are places in the country that are still just so. It's like when you hear about how it's illegal to sell a dildo in Alabama. You cannot buy or sell a vibrator in Alabama because the state Supreme Court said it was illegal. And you're like, what? And it just, it's like we were talking about the prohibition the other day, I guess after the show, we were talking about Boardwalk Empire or something. And how you can't wrap your brain around the fact that we ever got the entire country to sign off, or even a plurality of the country to sign off on prohibition. I cannot believe that there's still dry cities and dry counties. It really is just,
I've lived here in Portland for 20 years, and I still can't believe that we put up with the OLCC.
Oh, yeah.
Why do we still continued? Why have we not risen up and just driven out the OLCC?
I think it's because people don't really know what you would rise up against. I mean, it doesn't really seem like
They don't ever bother to leave the state, so they don't realize that we're paying basically an organized, I'm not going to call them organized crime, but we're paying.
Well, it's a monopoly.
We're paying a consortium.
Yeah.
You know, to run all of our booze for us, which, considering we're buying it directly from the distributor, means that it should be less expensive, yet we're paying like a third again more for hard liquor here than they pay in states where it's like a free market economy.
Yeah, no, it is a legally protected monopoly that the government here has on hard liquor. Yeah, there's no getting around that. But I don't know how the law works. This would be interesting. I'd like to find this out. I don't know if that's a thing we can just put it like as a ballot measure.
I don't see why not. I mean, it's a state run agency. It's a private agency that is, they basically managed to salve everything and grease palms by kicking a certain amount of their profits back into cities and county governments. And so that makes everybody, well, we like the OLCC because they give us money. But, you know, if we actually all rose up and voted it out, we would be able to do so.
I wonder if that's a thing we could do. I wonder if, like, we could collect ballot measures to just dismantle the OLCC.
It's just that it's not in anyone's. We'd have to find somebody in whose financial interest it was to do so. Like,
well,
a chain of liquor stores.
Well, you'd find Whole Foods or somebody,
yeah.
So like a place that wanted to be able to sell actual booze.
Does Walmart sell booze in other states? Because if you get like somebody like Walmart behind it, some big.
I think they sell beer and wine. I don't think they sell hard alcohol in other states. But then again, I don't really know.
But if you get like, say, Rite Aid, for example, you know, which sells hard liquor in other states,
yeah.
And get some big companies like that.
Well, but again,
it.
It's like, who is it? Is it is it New Seasons or Whole Foods? They were talking about running for mayor or something. The owner.
Oh, yeah.
Republican or something. Because it seems
or
like it
New
would.
Seasons.
I think it would be in her interest because it's like, you know, because the private industry and turning things, you know, less the man and more.
Well, you know, Fred Meyer, for example, you know, because you can buy hard liquor in supermarkets in other states. So Fred Meyer, Safeway, get some of them to throw some money behind it.
Apparently, Winco sells hard alcohol in California. So, and yeah, and I guess if we could, I guess if we could get the signatures, it is the thing we could put on the ballot to allow. But the thing is, here's why it would never pass, though, is that we would really just be talking about like Whole Foods being able to sell bourbon or whatever. But it is always positioned as just like a guy will be able to set up, you know, like a lemonade stand, you know, that happens to be selling Everclear to children.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way it always gets positioned. You know, it's like that you'll be able to, children will be able to walk into any store anywhere and, you know, go home with a case of Wild Turkey. So it's that is, you know. Yeah. And I guess in Walmart sells, as Keelan says, hella booze in Vegas. So, yeah, well, it doesn't really affect me, but I'm just. But it does irritate me though to no end. What time is it? 3:15. We should get ready to wrap this up so you can go do Hamfisted Radio. What shall we end with, Dawn?
I gotta read this story about the bear.
Okay.
Reports of a very bold black bear in McLennie, Florida, has the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission issuing some advice and warnings as they try to track and sadly kill it. The bear apparently broke into a home at 2 a.m. Monday. And grabbed food, including a birthday cake, before ambling off, according to commission spokeswoman Karen Parker. A commission biologist went to the home Tuesday to investigate and found a well-used trail behind it and lots of garbage spread around by the bear, as well as the remains of the birthday cake.
It's like he was having the saddest one bear party ever.
Yeah.
No one showed up. I guess I'll take the cake myself.
Since the bear appears to have a sweet tooth, wildlife officials set a trap baited with cupcakes. Commission biologist.
That's just cruel.
I know.
Is so cruel. That makes me angry.
Commission biologists know this bear since it was part of a research project at Camp Blanding and has been outfitted with a white collar and two ear tags. Biologists tracking the bear say it moved several miles south of McLennie by Tuesday morning, and when it is captured, it will be put down.
That infuriates me.
Yeah.
Who baits a trap with cupcakes? That violates. That seems like we're breaking part of the human contract with all the rest of the earth.
And I say, you know, of course, the bear went into a house and he stole a cake, and you don't want that happening again. But they're saying they can't relocate him because, you know, he knows that houses are full of cake now, and so apparently he will strike again. But yeah, bears are, black bears, by the way, are usually shy and avoid contact with humans, but their strong drive for birthday cake may overcome their shyness if they have easy access to human food, such as pet food, garbage, or livestock feed. So store your garbage and your bird feeders and stuff well. And also, you can report a bear if it's threatening you to the Wildlife Commission. You can find more, by the way, at myfwc.com/bear.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
My Fish and Wildlife Conservation
/bear.
Bear. But yes, they set a trap with cupcakes.
That is, see, that's just wrong. It just, I mean, it just.
Apparently, he was too clever for them, though, because he didn't go for it.
No matter what you're trying to catch, baiting a trap with cupcakes just seems, it seems like, you know, it's cheating. It seems like dirty pool.
Yeah, because you should be able to capture pretty much anything with cupcakes.
Honestly. Hey, so here's a question as we get ready to wrap this up. He's Winnie the Pooh. Mm-hmm. What is a poo?
I don't know.
Okay.
I've wondered that myself for many years.
All right. Todd, find that out for us, if you would. All right. And with that, we bring down the curtain on this, another exciting episode of the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Don't forget, you can hear Don Taylor today at 4 p.m. over at Pacific Time at Cascadia.fm, Hamfisted Radio, along with Mr. Bobby Fatboy Roberts. And you can also track that down later at hamfistedradio.com, or you can just leave cupcakes out and they'll show up at your house eventually. Just do it for you there. We want to thank our guests today, including Mr. Justin Stanley from uprisebooks.org. You can find that at uprisebooks.org. Tomorrow, Hoyt will be in the studio with us to talk about working the support center at a prominent online, the online offshoot of a prominent gaming console. I got to find a better way to say that. Then Friday, Big Jim Willig in the studio with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. After a brief musical interlude, we'll have an encore of the day's Legion of News, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milkpacking district here in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. As always, we thank you for listening. Be safe. See you tomorrow. Bye now.
Halloween.
Działo się to dawno, kiedy świat był stary. Tam, gdzie rzeczywistość jest jak senne mary. Z tej historii dziwnej płynie pewien morał. Może go pojmiecie, kiedy przyjdzie pora. Chcielibyście wiedzieć, skąd się wzięły święta? Tego i najstarszy upiór nie pamięta.
Czy ujdzie żyw, niech podąża szlakiem.